From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Steven Siegel spent 1 year writing Superman comics. The superhero's powers made him think about his own family's vulnerability to a hereditary disease, Huntington's disease, which killed his grandmother and his aunt. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Siegel about his new semi-autobiographical graphic novel, It's a Bird. Also, we meet Joey Burns, the singer-guitarist of the band Calexico. Their sound is inspired by music of the American Southwest. And music critic Milo Miles remembers punk rock guitarist Robert Quine, who was found dead on June 5th of an apparent suicide. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Thousands of people are lining Constitution Avenue in Washington as the procession carrying the body of former President Ronald Reagan makes its way to the Capitol. NPR's Brian Naylor was at the Ellipse near the White House as the caisson bearing the president's casket began its journey.
It's accompanied by a riderless horse with President Reagan's riding boots in the stirrups pointing backwards. Mrs. Reagan is in a limousine following that, and there is now a long, slow procession of black limousines heading up Constitution Avenue to the Capitol, where President Reagan will lie in state until funeral services on Friday.
NPR's Brian Naylor in Washington. Less than 3 hours before President Reagan's body was to be placed in the Capitol Rotunda, alarms went off in the Capitol, and the building was evacuated. More from NPR's David Wilma at the Capitol.
As sirens whooped through the Capitol, hundreds of people ran from the building, urged forcefully by Capitol police to flee for safety. Senators could be seen being pulled by their elbows to hasten their departure. As the Capitol's occupants gathered in nearby parks, word spread that a suspicious incoming flight triggered the evacuation. After an all-clear was issued and people were readmitted to the Capitol, a spokesman for Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist confirmed that a small aircraft carrying a VIP had mistakenly entered closed airspace near the Capitol. He did not deny reports the aircraft was carrying Kentucky Governor Ernie Fletcher, who was until last year a Republican congressman. David Wilna, NPR News, the Capitol.
Kurdish political leaders in Iraq are unhappy with part of the new United Nations resolution on Iraq and are hinting that they could withdraw from the interim government in reaction. NPR's Emily Harris says the Kurds are afraid they could fall under the domination of the country's majority Shia Arabs.
Kurds are a minority here in Iraq, and basically they've been governing three provinces by themselves, separate from Iraq, for the past 13 years. They're worried that in this new government they may lose some of the rights they've had, and they want some specific guarantees that they won't as the government goes forward.
NPR's Emily Harris in Baghdad. In Iraq today, insurgents blew up an oil pipeline that supplies a major power plant. Officials said the sabotage could cut Iraq's electricity production by about 10%. The damage comes as parts of the country are doing without electricity for more than 16 hours a day, and temperatures have been in excess of 100 degrees Fahrenheit. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 64 points to close at 10,368. The NASDAQ was down 33 points to 1990. This is NPR News. Broadcast giant Clear Channel has agreed to settle charges of indecency by the Federal Communications Commission. The company will pay more than $1.7 million to clear up hundreds of outstanding complaints. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Clear Channel said it did not agree that all the broadcasts in question were indecent, but the company said some clearly crossed the line and that Clear Channel wanted to put the issue behind it. The payment essentially wipes the slate clean for the company, which has faced some of the stiffest FCC indecency fines. Clear Channel had already announced a zero-tolerance policy for indecency and has dumped two controversial jocks from its lineup, including Howard Stern. FCC Chair Michael Powell hailed the agreement as a victory for the public, but Commissioner Michael Copps dissented. Copps has crusaded for tougher decency standards, and he objected to giving Clear Channel a free pass rather than examining each outstanding complaint from listeners. Congress has yet to approve a law that would greatly increase the maximum indecency fine. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Heads of state from the group of eight major industrial countries formally began their summit today on Sea Island off the coast of Georgia. The interim president of Iraq, Ghazi al-Yawar, took part in a lunch meeting devoted to President Bush's plans for encouraging democratic reform in the Middle East. The leaders of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Morocco declined invitations to come to the meeting, reflecting unease over the plan in the Arab world. President Bush told the other G8 leaders today that he'd like to see NATO troops become more involved in Iraq. French President Jacques Chirac said he didn't think NATO should take on a role in Iraq unless it was invited to do so by the new interim government. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What comic book writer would pass up the opportunity to write Superman? The answer is my guest, Steven Siegel. After resisting, he eventually gave in and spent a year writing stories for the Man of Steel. His new book is a graphic novel based on that experience called It's a Bird. The paradox at the center of the story is that as Siegel writes for a hero who has inherited superpowers, he's haunted by Huntington's disease, a hereditary illness that killed his grandmother and his aunt that he may or may not carry. Siegel has also written the comics Uncanny X-Men, House of Secrets, Sandman Mystery Theater, and Vertical. Steven Siegel, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to read a passage from your new graphic novel, It's a Bird. And this is the part in which you, may I use the word you, are on the phone?
Sure. It's like me.
Yes,
it's
okay.
It's me-ish.
Good. So you or you-ish is on the phone with your editor, and he's trying to talk you into writing Superman comics. And his name, the editor's name, is Jeremy. Would you read it?
Sure. I can't, Jer. Sorry, it's not working for me. I'm not the man for this job. I've been thinking it over, and the pieces don't add up. You know, the costume, the secret identity, the origin. Superman doesn't hold water in the real world. Jeremy makes this face every time he's plotting out how to contradict everything I've just said. And he says, "You don't work in the real world. You work in fantasy. It doesn't need to be logical. Just take the costume for granted. He has the costume. And the secret identity, don't tell me that's not believable. Everybody's got secrets. I've got some. Don't you? Look, you don't have to reconcile every piece of his history. But I tell him, I like things to be believable. For me to write Superman, I have to believe he could live in our world, but he can't. Everything about him is ludicrous. Even that mantra, faster than a speeding locomotive, more powerful than a bullet, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird. He cuts me off. You've got the mantra wrong. Don't expect to understand Superman if you haven't done your homework. I don't accept your refusal. Here, read these. Then come back to me. You won't say no. He gives me a stack of Superman comics. I know it's a challenge, but what Jeremy doesn't know is that I will win. I'll take Superman head on. We'll see who's stronger.
And that's Steven Siegel reading from his new autobiographical graphic novel, It's a Bird. So, Steven, you really did turn down Superman, huh?
I did.
Initially.
But the book is semi-autobiographical, so the facts are all right. They're just all in the wrong order.
And what made you decide to actually do it after all?
Well, I wrote this book, which contains 20 short stories that kind of dissect everything spectacular about Superman, but still find him holding up to anything I can throw at him. And I thought, that's a pretty strong character. You know, if I can really deconstruct him and still find him to be a powerful figure iconically, then maybe I should try to take him on. So when the offer actually did come through, I did a year on the actual Superman comic.
Now let's get to your graphic novel. The great paradox in this story is that you've been asked to write about the Man of Steel, the man who is invulnerable to everything except kryptonite, but you're feeling quite vulnerable, and your family is quite vulnerable because a couple of people in your family have died of Huntington's disease, a disease of the nervous system, which is very, very, very bad and very disabling, and it's inherited.
Correct,
so
yeah.
The question is, who's going to get it next in the family? So the paradox is, as you're about to consider drawing a superhero, you're thinking about how vulnerable your family is to this genetic disease. Did you always see Superman in terms of that paradox?
Well, when I got into writing comic books, I didn't start with superheroes. I started more with crime comics and kind of noir mysteries. And so the superhero paradox didn't occur to me initially because I wasn't working on these super powerful characters. But when I actually did start thinking about them, it was right at the time that my aunt, Sarah, was really going through the final stages of Huntington's, and it did become an ironic juxtaposition that, you know, I'm writing characters who can do anything, and here's a woman who, you know, one week loses the power to swallow, and, you know, another week no longer can speak anymore, and it really just started to weigh heavily on me that what I was supposed to write was a fantasy that was so detached from this reality that I was looking at.
And, you know, some people would take comfort in the fact that there is such a fantasy of invulnerability to fall back on at a time when you're feeling most vulnerable. And for other people, that fantasy would seem useless and pointless and almost make you angry.
I'm told on occasion that I'm too logical about things. And I think that if I looked at it emotionally initially, I would have said, this is a great escape, which is what comic books are in America. One of the reasons why they deal so exclusively with power fantasy is that that's an escape for people who feel powerless. You know, kids in school reading comic books are looking to be stronger than they are looking to be super. And that's the emotional registration. But I think I was looking at them logically because I was writing them as a vocation. And so I just started tearing them apart. I thought, let's just tear down everything that makes Superman super. And as it turned out, he could stand up to anything I could throw at him.
You write about what a really terrible and tragic ending you come to if you have Huntington's disease. And the character is saying this when he is seeing his aunt dying of it. He says, there's no good thing to hope for a Huntington's patient. If you hope they're fine except for the body, you're condemning them to a life sentence lived out inside a useless shell. If you hope they're vegetative and mentally gone, then you've condemned them to a meaningless living death. What did you think about your aunt when you actually saw her dying? What were you hoping that she was experiencing or not experiencing?
Well, we went through, as a family, a lot of different stages with her. She was in a rest home out here in California for just many, many years. And there was a time where people didn't want to go visit her because it was very difficult to look at her and think that could be any one of us next. And when we finally, you know, mustered up the courage to get over that, which we definitely should have, then I started thinking about, well, what should I hope for her? You know, do I hope that she dies soon? Do I hope that she hangs on so that she doesn't die? And that was what I came to, is that there was not really a good alternative for me to hope for, because on the one hand, she was completely incapacitated. And I became obsessed with whether she could understand anything I was saying to her, because the disease causes the neurons in your brain to misfire. And so one of the symptoms of that is a kind of uncontrolled movement. And so you would say something and she would move and you wouldn't know if that was a response to what you were saying or just her brain playing tricks on her. And it really became a dichotomy of just, you know, do I hope that she dies soon or do I hope that she keeps living? And neither one seemed like a good thing.
There's a scene in your graphic novel in which you as a boy overhear your father saying that if he really knew about Huntington's disease in the family and if he knew that it could be passed on, he wouldn't have had children. Did you ever overhear your father say something like that?
The book is semi-autobiographical, and that part is more autobiographical than not. Again, it's, you know, the way that it's staged in the book takes place over a week, and the story of my life takes place over my entire life. So the book, I think, makes it look a little more crass and calculated than it was. But there were conversations like that where my parents would talk to other parents and wouldn't know that my brother and I were still awake and, you know, eavesdropping, which we shouldn't have been. And we would overhear things like this. And I, you know, the thing that the book really helped me with was that I understand why they say that. And the book, if nothing else, is, you know, a laurel to my parents that says, thank you anyway. You know, I don't care if I come down with this fatal disease, anything might come to get me. I really appreciate my life and the way it's turned out and the things that I've done. But I know that it's just been a heavy weight on them, you know, all along, this thought of that they might have damned their own children, which is a terrible thing to have to consider.
And are you considering having children?
It depends. I mean, we're in a different world now. There are genetic tests that can determine whether you are carrying the gene or not. My own father is over 70 now and didn't inherit Huntington's. So, you know, I could certainly confirm if I decided to have children with my very significant other, Liesl Reinhardt. We could have that test and, you know, be able to determine whether it was even a risk or not, which is kind of a great thing. It's certainly not something that was available to my parents. But Nancy Wexler, a doctor, you know, isolated the gene and came up with this test. And even she was on NPR, I think, a week ago on All Things Considered talking about, you know, having come up with a test, didn't know if she should get it or not. Who wants to know?
My guest is Steven Siegel. His new graphic novel is called It's a Bird. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic book writer Steven Siegel. He spent a year writing Superman comics. As he was writing about a superhero, he was thinking about his family's vulnerability to the hereditary disease Huntington's disease. It killed his aunt and his grandmother.
So your experiences have really taught you that your body can turn against you, that you can inherit great strengths, but you can also inherit a deadly vulnerability. Have you tried to work ideas like that into your Superman stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing in the world Huntington's did for me was serve as a wake-up call, which is just to say that you have no idea what's going to get you. And it's, you know, it's a tired saying, but people really don't embrace it to the degree that they need to. Anything might get me. You know, I'm at risk for heart disease just because I'm a male. But you don't know if you're going to develop something or not. You really have to live in the moment. You have to live in a way that is consistent with your happiness. You really have to grab the things that you want out of life while you can, because you don't know what your genes or fate or whatever has in store for you the day after tomorrow. So that part of wish fulfillment really does impact the work that I've done on superheroes, and that I think they represent an ideal of living well. And I don't think there is any other lesson in life except live well. Do well by yourself, do well by others, and you're not going to go too wrong. And I think that that is an easy thing to pull out of the superhero mythologies.
But then there's also that point for many people in which that period of your life is over. And from this moment on, you're living with the vulnerability. You're living with the weakness. You're living with a problem that isn't going to go away. Has that sense ever entered your superhero comics? I mean, does that maybe not belong in there, or have you given it to other characters?
Well, it's certainly something that plays out in the non-genre stuff. You know, superheroes, I'm of two minds about. I think that comics, in a global sense, have matured a lot, and in the United States, they've really rested more in the superhero camp, which I think is unfortunate. There are lots of great works out that are not superhero-centered. So I think it's tough then for people to accept that there are headier themes, which is one of the great things about doing this book, in that it combines kind of mature adult themes and sensibilities with an iconic superhero character like Superman and says, look, this story can still work. I mean, I think it's a comic book that most people wouldn't think to themselves as a comic book when they're done, hopefully. And I don't say that to blow my own horn. I say it to show the flexibility of this medium there. You can do a lot of things. That said, I always think to myself that mostly superhero comics are for kids, and I don't want to bum their high. You know, I want them to have great, fun stories, you know, of superheroes. I do remember when I was growing up, Captain Marvel, the Marvel Comics character, died of cancer. And I was like, what? You know, it was revelatory, but it was, and there was nothing super about it. He just succumbed to cancer and he wasted away, and that was that. And it was kind of a watershed comic book for back in the day.
How'd you feel about that? Did you feel, like, cheated or angry?
You know, I came from a Huntington's family, so I felt like, hooray, Captain Marvel died of something noble.
That's the thing. No. There's always going to be at least one kid out there who wants, he's going to identify with the vulnerability and not the wish fulfillment of the strength.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a great story at the time. I knew he was heroic, and I understood what happened to him. And it's just the way the story is told. Mm-hmm, so long as mm-hmm. the facts are put out there, I think kids can understand a lot more than we give them credit for. I know that the It's a Bird book has made it into some teen library collections, which I think is great. I think a teen that's a reader would get this book and not have any trouble with it.
In the year that you were writing Superman, did you do anything to address the kind of problems that you explained earlier that you had, like his secret identity, the silly costume, all the things about Superman that initially made you think that you couldn't really write for him?
I'm sure things like that found their way through the year of work that I did. But to be honest, I had really purged myself by doing this book right before that. And so most of that year, I spent just trying to take Superman for what he was, a hero. Kind of like the editor says, he has the costume, he has the secret identity. So I just tried to accept that. Whether I succeeded or not, is up to the fans, as it always is.
When you agreed to do Superman, were you presented with a list of rules or standards, with a Bible, as they call it, in TV sitcom land, that tells you what the character can do, what he can't, what about other characters, the guidelines for the story?
Well, one of the cool things about our industry is that most of the people who work in it are comic book fans. So a lot of that, it's assumed that you know his rogues gallery and that you know his powers. And more than that, it's assumed that you will try to find new ways to use those powers and those characters. We did have a big meeting just to sit down and talk about where he was at the time and where he was going in the future and, things we might do to make the character as interesting as possible. The coolest thing I would say, though, is that when I came to D.C. with the idea to do the It's a Bird book with Teddy Christensen, who's the artist on it, a fabulous painter who lives in Copenhagen, I said, this is not going to be at all what you know about this character. It's going to really do some different things with him, and it's going to push into some maybe uncomfortable territory, and here's why I want to do it, and here's how I want to do it. And without batting an eye, they said, absolutely, do it. And I think that that's a testament to the character. Superman is strong enough and flexible enough that you can really do a lot of things to him, with him, for him. And he just keeps standing. He's been around since 1938, and nothing I can do is going to stop that.
What are some of the changes you wanted to make to Superman?
In my book or on the regular comic?
On the regular comic.
I thought it would have been great if he became a parent somehow, and was actually kind of working toward that, but didn't find the way to tell that story well. So I didn't do it, but I thought that would be an interesting change to see how he and Lois Lane, they're married these days. I don't know if you know that or not. And Lex Luthor is president of the United States. My, how Metropolis has changed.
Oh, wait. Lois Lane is a reporter for Action News. You want to talk about change? What are some of the other ways, for those of us who haven't been keeping up with Superman, what are some of the other ways the story has changed?
Well, actually, the story is taking a big turn right now. They've just introduced a new creative team on the book that's doing something that, to be honest, I don't even know where it's going. A lot of people on Earth have suddenly vanished, and I don't know if it's the second coming or who knows what. But the thing about Superman is that he'll have long hair for a while, and then they'll make it short again. He'll get different jobs. During my tenure, he got put on the police beat, kind of a demotion, because he was finding corruption in the Lex Luthor presidential campaign re-election stuff. And, the jobs will change. But the thing that I find most enduring about Superman and most endearing about him also is just that he is so consistent. Some people find that to be a limitation. I find it to be really actually quite excellent. There are so few things that you can look at and say, I know exactly what that is. And Superman is that. He's an ideal. He's an iconic standard of goodness and right, which some people think is boring. It's very Boy Scout. But, in a world that's as morally gray as the world I find myself living in, I think it's refreshing that something can represent an ideal that consistently over time.
The creators of Superman were both Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I find that interesting in the sense that, the Clark Kent character, the Superman's secret identity as Clark Kent, he's brought up in this Midwestern family. It's so not Jewish. And it seems so
It's mythic America.
Oh, I suppose so, right. It's certainly not the kind of home that the two creators of Superman were probably brought up in.
No, but if you think about it, you know, Siegel and Shuster were very smart in that what they created for Superman was a story of coming from another world and trying to make good in the place where you find yourself, which is the story of so many Jewish immigrants. And that's exactly the story of Superman, who comes from the planet Krypton and goes to Metropolis and tries to make good and do right, you know, and make a name for himself by doing good, solid work and by helping people. So I think that it's a metaphor for, you know, the Jewish immigration into America at the time that they found themselves here.
Did you ever watch Superman on TV?
I watched some of the reruns now and then, but, you know, that was kind of pre-cable. when my parents never would get cable. They were anti-cable. They're still anti-cable. So it was not at my disposal so easily. But I did like the kind of stoicness of it. You know, I remember it as being very, static.
How did the costume look to you on TV versus how it looks in the comics?
Very gray. You know, one of the things that I always find interesting is that when you read about potential movies back when it was Christopher Reeve and the current go-round, that people are always concerned about the costume. You know, how will I look in the costume? But I think it's a great-looking costume, you know, by and large. If you're going to dress up in spandex colors, that's the way to go. Because it's a costume that when you look at it, you know what it looks like. You could draw it right after seeing it once, which is, that's tough to do. I wouldn't say that about really any other superheroes.
You said it looked very gray. I mean, Superman is very primary colors, and on black and white, black and white,
yeah,
TV.
I seem to remember it as a black and white show, yeah.
Yeah.
But the logo, that S, which is kind of what begins our book, is just the idea of that stylistic S, you know, that really burned into my mind. And I think that's why the book begins with that, is that when I think of Superman, I just think of that logo, you know, and it's on T-shirts and products and everything. It really has made a mark in the global consciousness.
Jay never thought of it quite that way, that he's like the guy who wears his own logo all the time. He's branded himself.
Absolutely.
Steven Siegel's new graphic novel is called It's a Bird. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by HBO, offering Band of Brothers on DVD. Produced by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, it is based on the true story of Easy Company in World War II. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Full Dark Horse, the first Bryant and May mystery, a novel of two octogenarian British detectives by Christopher Fowler. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet Joey Burns of the band Calexico. Also, Milo Miles remembers punk rock guitarist Robert Quine, who was found dead, an apparent suicide, last Saturday. He was 61. And we continue our interview with comic book writer Steven Siegel.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic book writer Steven Siegel. He wrote Superman comics for a year. His new semi-autobiographical graphic novel, It's a Bird, is based on that year. It's also about his thoughts on the superhero and his own vulnerability.
Are there fantasies that you've had over the years that you managed to work into comic stories, Superman or other ones?
Fantasies, you know, again, I'm a literal kind of person, and so really what I tend to work into my work is my life, but my family is really weird. Like, we've had a lot of strange experiences. My dad looks like Richard Nixon and was once mistaken by the Secret Service for him and carted away because they thought Nixon had gotten up. My dad was where Nixon was at the time. It was a graduation at the Air Force Academy, and my dad was working it, and they thought that Nixon had wandered away from the security perimeter. And you know, we checked into a motel once that had blood under throw rugs, just fresh puddles of blood, you know, just weird things like that. Those things tend to find their way into my work, which is why I felt like at some point Huntington's and the mark that that made on us really had to, even though it's kind of one of the last things I got to.
How did the Nixon story end up in a comic? What was the story? How did you use it?
I didn't use that exact story that way, but just the idea of mistaken identity, you know, I was thinking about some of my earlier comics, that's all over the place in those where people think someone is someone else. But my family has such rich, odd stories that's really played out in my work far more than my own fantasies because so many weird things had happened. And in real life, it played out that as soon as my dad spoke, he doesn't sound anything like Richard Nixon. They knew they had the wrong guy.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it's very strange. Family photos of my family from the... you know, from when I was 2 or 3 years old, is my mom, my dad, my brother, and Richard Nixon.
Did you ever find out whose blood was under the rugs?
You know, that was very troubling, but we were traveling cross-country. My dad won't fly, though he was in the Air Force, which is another strangely ironic juxtaposition. So we would drive, and he would just drive until we'd leave North or South Carolina and drive straight through to California. And we were just so tired that we checked into this hotel. And it was the only room that was left. I think we were in San Antonio, in the whole city. We had stopped at every hotel, and they said, here's our last room. And we went in, and my mom at the time had medication overlap kind of before that was diagnosed. So they didn't know, and she was kind of a little edgy all the time. And she looked at the adjoining room door and said, well, I'm not going to sleep because somebody could break in here and kill us just by coming through that door. And my dad said, fine, and he pushed the dresser in front of it, and... Then she said, well, why would there be a throw rug on the floor? You know, you don't put a throw rug on carpet. And she lifted it up, and there was the blood, and we were out of that room and in the car and driving to California. Didn't stay.
Gosh. And how did you use that in a story?
A lot of the comics that I work on are for the Vertigo imprint of DC Comics. This book, the Superman book, It's a Bird, is also for that imprint. But those comics tend to be, more like a PG to an R-rated movie as opposed to a G-rated movie. Comics definitely for an adult audience. And one of the books I worked on was called Sandman Mystery Theater, which was a crime noir set in the 1930s. And so I had a similar discovery of blood in one of those mysteries.
What other comics are you drawing now?
I'm at present working on Encyclopedia Brown, who was the boy detective, doing a graphic novel series of that. And then I'm with Teddy Christensen, the artist on It's a Bird, working on our follow-up project, which we have three things. We haven't settled yet on which one it will be. And then I'm also doing a comic book that's another political thriller, which is kind of the way that I started, called Persona, which is about my neighborhood in Altadena, where I live, and mysterious goings-on.
How did you get matched up with Teddy Christensen, the artist who you collaborate with on It's a Bird, and who you've worked with him on other things as well? The artwork is really beautiful in the book.
The artwork is beautiful. That poor man, I've worked with Teddy for a number of years, and one of the things he always says to me is, challenge me. So when I came up with this idea, I was actually at his house, and he said, what are we going to do next? And I said, I don't know. And moments later, I had the complete book just fly into my head, in its totality. And I said, well, Teddy, I now do know what we're going to do. Here's the bad news. It has to be drawn in 20 completely different art styles. And he did that, and not just drew it, but he painted it. You know, one of the cool things about graphic novels is their ability to shift into other art styles. And I don't even know that people looking at this would think, as you were saying, that you didn't know they put names on the cover. But a lot of people don't know that they paint comic books. And this comic book is completely painted in a number of different medium. And I had met Teddy years before at a comic book convention, And it was a very loud, bustling place. And he said that I was the only quiet, calm thing in the room, so he was drawn toward me. We had a conversation and started working together and have been working together ever since. But I really like that he's a European artist, which gives him a, kind of a different sensibility. You know, this book is very muted in its tones, except for Superman, who has this kind of red, yellow, blue bolt of lightning that hits the pages.
How do you like the way the artist Teddy Christensen has drawn you for your graphic novel, It's a Bird?
I think I look devastatingly sexy, so I love it. and of course, it's not really me. So if he's got too much of a chin here and there, or hasn't shaved, or looks a little tired, I can always claim it's not really me.
Okay. Steven Siegel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Steven Siegel's new graphic novel is called It's a Bird. Coming up, Joey Burns of the band Calexico. This is Fresh Air. The band Calexico takes its name from a California border town, although the two founders of the band now live in Tucson. Their music sounds like the Southwest. Even some of their cover recordings sound like a mariachi band is sitting in. Calexico was founded in 1996 by drummer John Convertino and my guest, singer, guitarist, and songwriter Joey Burns. They've both also played with Giant Sand and Friends of Dean Martinez. Calexico's new EP, Convict Pool, opens with their version of a song by the band Love called Alone Again Or. Alone Again Or from the new Calexico album. Joey Burns, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you end up covering this song that was first recorded by the Love Group?
Well, we're a fan of the group, and somebody had suggested that we cover the song, a number of friends, and so we did.
Did they see an affinity?
Yeah, they did. I think that was the reason why. And I grew up in Los Angeles, so I had heard a bunch of bands from the 60s and 70s and 80s that had all experienced in playing psychedelic pop and rock music.
Now, that was an era when a lot of pop actually had horns in it, which...
That's true.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how you decided to include trumpets in your music. I don't think you initially did.
No, I didn't. Having played in so many rock bands growing up and having so much guitar and distortion going on as kind of the solo instrument, we kind of drifted to some of our roots, which was, for John, listening to a lot of classical and jazz music, and for me, listening to the same, and also kind of getting into more world music as well as independent music and experimental music. And the idea of going outside of the norm and tapping into textures and sounds and instruments and arrangements that kind of explore more color and expression seemed to kind of come naturally to us. We wanted to find out what we could as far as, you know, going outside and of the traditional rock and roll arrangements, and I don't know, try to bring something new, but also kind of following in a tradition.
Now, something that a lot of people who write about you mention is the apparent influence of the soundtracks of Ennio Morricone, who, among other things, did Once Upon a Time in America, Once Upon a Time in the West, and
sure.
the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly for a fistful of dollars, a few dollars more. Is it a fact? Have you been influenced by
that? Sure. I mean, gosh, yeah, about 8 years ago, I bought a Rhino Records compilation of all of his soundtrack works, and they're beautiful pieces, and they're very surreal and innovative in the arrangements and the use of doubling of instruments and voices. And I mean, there's a direct link between Link Wray, Dick Dale, Ennio Morricone, that kind of minor blues, gypsy blues. And it was all recorded in the early 60s. And so it has that beautiful openness and sound in the production that really, to me, sounds like a whole band or orchestra playing live, which is rare these days.
What neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in Southern California in a town called Palos Verdes, which is a pretty affluent community. My parents moved there in the late 60s and were able to, you know, get a good house for a relatively good deal. And the whole 70s, I spent growing up just seeing the property value just skyrocket. And I knew from then on that I would never be able to buy a home where I grew up. It's impossible, especially being a musician. But it was a beautiful place because it was right next to the sea, and so I spent a lot of time just by the ocean and watching people surf and skateboard. And that's what this Convict Pool song is inspired by. It's inspired by skateboarding in abandoned pools.
Oh. Well, why don't we hear it? That's the title
sure.
track of the new CD. So this is Calexico, Convict Pool.
Execution. In the deep, but taking it into the shallow is not a problem. Escape, convict fool, escape, convict. Check the underwriter killers for video surveillance of the convict pool and the warden's son's private collection. Escape, convict pool.
That's from Calexico's new CD. It's the title track, Convict Pool. My guest, Joey Burns, is a songwriter, guitarist, and singer with Calexico. Did you watch Westerns at all when you were young? I think
sure, I watched a couple, but you know, it's not like I dwelled on it. I dwelled more on, you know, skateboarding and listening to Led Zeppelin.
Right, right. So you skateboard a lot when you were young?
Yeah, we had a ramp, and like I said earlier, there was a lot of...
Yeah.
You know, emptied pools that we would go seek and take refuge in the summer. And that song, Convict Pool, was inspired by an article in a skateboard magazine because they had an edition on pools. And I was really surprised at the magazine. I hadn't seen one in a while. So not that I'm a practicing skateboarder right now, but I appreciate, you know, the sport.
Where do you record?
Normally we record here in Tucson, Arizona, at Wave Lab Studio, which is run by Craig Schumacher and Nick Luca. It's an analog studio. It's in an old AT&T telephone building. And there's no differentiating between the control room and the cutting room. It's all one big space. And so everyone's kind of there. And it's the vibe is mostly about just kind of being in the moment and going with the flow and seeing what happens, so, which is very, it's perfect for improvising and playing live, I think.
So you play live, you all play together. It's not one track layered on another.
Well, we do that too, actually, because a lot of the members in our group live in different parts of the U.S. and in Europe. We're kind of scattered, so we usually start things by playing as a duo, but we've also done things live too, which is a lot of fun.
Are you able to make a living with music?
Yeah, I keep pretty busy with music, and I do things, as far as the managerial aspects, I handle a lot of that work, but the labels we work with are really run efficiently, both here and in Europe. And so it makes my job a lot easier.
Your job as a performer, or your job trying to help promote the band?
Kind of manage the band and be in the band.
Mm-hmm. The way some indie bands get known now is that a song of theirs gets picked up by a commercial advertiser, and the music is used on a TV commercial. It used to be people hated to be on TV commercials, but now it's another way to break a band. Would you want that to happen?
Well, actually, it's happened to us. Just recently, we licensed one of our songs to Adidas for a campaign. And the thing for me that I felt strongly about doing this was the material that was shown with Muhammad Ali from probably the late 60s, training for a fight. And I just really wanted to see the music that we had made of the song Papita together with, footage of Muhammad Ali. And in hindsight, though, I think it's tough because you start digging deeper into the idea of supporting corporations, and then it kind of starts spinning around on itself as far as this idea of trying to maintain a sense of independence. And that's getting harder and harder to uphold here in the United States because a lot of venues and a lot of radio stations are bought out by companies like Clear Channel. And that's becoming more and more a debate, especially around a lot of my friends in the independent music industry.
I want to close with an instrumental from the new Calexico CD, and it's called Praskovia. Would you talk about writing this?
Sure. The song is inspired by that great time signature 3/4, the waltz. And one day in the studio, both John Convertino and myself were just messing around with accordions. And so we started coming up with this theme, and it kept on expanding and going. And then we made a take of it, and next thing you knew, we had this beautiful waltz.
Is it reminiscent at all of anything your grandfather or his father played on accordion?
Yeah, I would definitely say that it harkens back to maybe some of our familial roots. Both John, his father played accordion, was an Italian-American, played piano and accordion and in the household and professionally. And my grandfather played accordion, he's a German-American background. And so, yeah, all that stuff comes flooding through, subliminally and consciously, all at the same time.
Joey Burns is the co-founder of Calexico. Their new CD is called Convict Pool.
We'll be right back.
That's Calexico. Coming up, Milo Miles remembers punk guitarist Robert Quine. He was found dead Saturday, an apparent suicide. This is Fresh Air. Punk guitarist Robert Quine was found dead on Saturday, an apparent suicide. He was 61. Friends say he was despondent over the sudden death of his wife last year. Quine is remembered for shaping the sound of the 70s groundbreaking punk band Richard Hell and the Voidoids. A devoted fan of the Velvet Underground, Quine played with Lou Reed in the 80s. He went on to play with Matthew Sweet and Lloyd Cole in the 90s, as well as John Zorn. Music critic Milo Miles has an appreciation.
In 1977, songs like Richard Hell and the Voidoids' Another World revealed that punk rock could be dense and sly in unexpected ways. And the secret was brilliant primitivist guitar work from Robert Quine. There's a standard progression with great rock and roll instrumentalists. They start out fiery and expressive, and, in the romantic tradition, burn out and become mere echoes or self-parodies. Eventually, you see their name on a record, and you know it's supposed to make you buy it. But it doesn't. Robert Quine was one of the rare exceptions. To this day, for those in the know, seeing that he plays on an album makes it 10 times more interesting. Quine's sharp ear rewarded your own. You could hear what he heard in 50s masters like Chuck Berry, James Burton, and Jimmy Reed. You could hear what he later heard in John Coltrane and the Velvet Underground. But what you most liked to hear was how he put it all together and took it giant steps further. Quine grew up in Akron, Ohio, and did time in San Francisco and New Jersey writing tax law before he committed himself to music. By the time he recorded with the Voidoids, Quine had mastered his own guitar language, and his technique fit into a perfect middle ground. He described himself as a musical illiterate, but by punk standards, he was a virtuoso. And when he moved on to play with one of his old idols, Lou Reed, the result was the most challenging and inventive sound of Reed's solo career. Waves of fear. Waves of fear. Waves of fear. Waves of fear. We'll be right back. A fine visual record of this period can be found on the DVD, A Night with Lou Reed. Quine went on to make fascinating, slightly off-kilter pop songs with Matthew Sweet and Lloyd Cole, as well as noisier ambient instrumentals, notably with saxophonist John Zorn. Quine never gave up, and he never pandered to an audience. But he also never located an ideal vehicle for all his guitar inventions at once. Quine's finest recent work appeared on the album Painted Desert, which came out under percussionist Ikuyi Morey's name. But whether Quine was in tumult or reverie, he sometimes reached a mixture of sadness and bliss that resembled that of another idol, Lester Young. At those times, Quine's guitar would just sail, intimate, protective, lost in a perfect blue dream, headed toward a place always worth the search.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. Guitarist Robert Quine died last week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From HBO, offering Band of Brothers on DVD. Produced by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, it is based on the true story of Easy Company in World War II. By Six Degrees Records, presenting the new self-titled release from Brazilian pop singer Bebel Gilberto. More information at sixdegreesrecords.com. And from Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. And we talk with satirist and reporter P.J. O'Rourke, whose target is often liberal politics. His new book is Peace Kills, America's Fun New Imperialism. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.